In the coming week, the impeachment of President Trump moves to the Senate, China tries to suppress a mysterious illness ahead of the Lunar New Year, and the World Economic Forum annual meeting is held in Davos, Switzerland. It's January 16, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, the U.S. House of Representatives has voted to send the impeachment case to the Senate, which will decide if President Trump is to be acquitted or convicted on two counts. But Jim, can you give us a sense of what we'll be looking for in the week ahead on this and what is most notable?
Certainly, Bob. And let's note that the trial process is actually going to begin today. And by the time this podcast airs, three things will have happened.
Okay.
One, Chief Justice John Roberts will have sworn in all 100 senators who will have pledged, let me quote the oath here, to do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws. Two, the Senate will have adopted by simple majority vote the rules that will actually govern the trial. And the third thing is that the Senate will have issued what's called a writ of summons that will go to the White House, inviting him to participate in the trial. And again, there are two counts that the House has brought against President Trump in impeaching him. One involves the issue of abuse of office. The other one involves obstruction of Congress.
And already you've scoped out what looks like a very different process than what we just witnessed in the House over the last several weeks,
well,
right?
It's a very different process because, one, the Senate has a different role here. Its role is simply decide whether the facts of the case merit the president's removal from office. Now, keep in mind, the president can be removed if either of the articles of impeachment garner the support of two-thirds of the senators. Okay, so it doesn't require conviction on both counts, just one count. The other reason it's going to be different, of course, is that the House of Representatives is controlled by the Democrats. In this case, in the Senate, it's controlled by the Republicans. And so the Republicans will be responding to the leadership of Senator Mitch McConnell, but obviously to President Trump, who is the leader of their party. Now, the actual mechanics of the impeachment trial, which will probably kick off on Tuesday, are a lot different than we're used to. And I'll flag a couple of things. One is that senators are expected to attend the trial. It's going to run from Monday through Saturday once it gets underway. Senators don't have to worry about getting up early in the morning because the trial won't actually convene each day until 1 p.m. But here's the key thing. All senators must attend. They have to sit at their desks. They can't talk or even ask questions. And let me quote here, on pain of imprisonment. They can only read impeachment-related materials. And this may be the killer for a modern politician. They are prohibited from using their electronics. So no iPads, no iPhones, no Samsung Notes or anything quite like
this
that.
This sounds like a different world than we're used to seeing.
It is a different world. And again, the senators are supposed to sit there and act as jurors, not be engaged in other business. Now, it's important to note that the case can be dismissed at any time by a majority vote, but the Republicans currently don't have support to do that. And the way it'll work is the House managers will present their essentially indictment of the president. That's expected to take several days. It will then be followed by the president's defense, also expected to take several days. Senators will then have an opportunity to ask questions, but again, their questions must be submitted in writing, and the managers and defense lawyers can respond verbally. Now, one of the big open questions here is whether or not we are going to see witnesses come before the Senate. And that's one of the big questions. As you know, there's been a lot of talk, a lot of demands by Democrats that the Senate should bring in witnesses. For example, John Bolton, former National Security Advisor. Republicans have been very reluctant to agree to bringing in witnesses. But at some point, there's an expectation that the Senate will vote on whether to bring in additional witnesses to testify. And again, in this thing, if Democrats maintain solidarity to be able to call witnesses, they're going to have to get at least four Republicans to switch sides and vote for bringing in witnesses. And so there's a lot of attention being placed on senators like Mitt Romney of Utah, Susan Collins of Maine, Cory Gardner of Nevada, Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska as the Republicans who would be the most likely to vote to bring in witnesses. But we're probably a couple weeks away from seeing that happen. One once that portion of the trial concludes, assuming we do bring in witnesses, and I should note that it won't be like a moment from Perry Mason in which witnesses appear before the full Senate. Most likely, they will give depositions on the sidelines to small groups of selected senators that which will be videotaped, and those portions relevant could be used in the trial. But it's not going to be sort of that big Hollywood moment.
So this wouldn't be like what we saw in the House hearings, which involved these, in many cases, these lifelong civil servants who were coming in to testify about what they knew or heard about this case, which at its core involves Ukrainian officials who may have been asked to, you know, find dirt on presidential candidate Joe Biden and what the president's role was in that.
Yeah, it will be different than that. If you go back to the impeachment trial of Bill Clinton, you didn't have live testimony by witnesses. And I will note, and this is one of the hard things to sort of gauge, is will public pressure build on Republicans to call witnesses? Now, one of the things that's happened in the nearly month since the House voted on the two articles of impeachment is that more information has come out about what happened in the dealings between the Trump administration and Ukraine. Most notably, in the last couple of days, Lev Parnas, who's under indictment, apparently turned over a variety of documents to the House that have been released, which tend to buttress the argument being made by the House impeachment managers. He also gave an interview last night to Rachel Maddow of MSNBC, which didn't help the president's case. And also, just as we were sitting under the podcast, news broke that the General Accountability Office, the GAO, which is a nonpartisan operation of Congress, has concluded that the administration violated the law in holding up aid to Ukraine. So how that's going to play out, whether that moves the needle publicly, remains to be seen.
Yeah, and on the Ukrainian side, also coming out today, there's been a flurry of news, and I suspect we'll see more. Ukrainians themselves have announced they're mounting an investigation into whether or not the U.S. ambassador at the time, Marie Jovanovich, was being improperly surveilled by Ukrainians. So there's a great deal of concern about improper behavior happening across the board, and it's adding to, as you said, Jim, the pressure that is going to mount on these senators about to the extent to which they dig further into this case or not.
One thing I'll just note, if people are watching the proceedings on television, and one of the interesting questions to follow will be what percentage of American TVs are tuned into the impeachment trial, that the cameras in the Senate chamber are operated by Senate employees. None of the networks or cable news channels have a say about where those cameras are pointed. And indeed, the president of CNN has been arguing that CNN should be allowed to have cameras in the Senate so it can make its independent editorial decisions about where to focus cameras. Just before we wrap this session up, I think there are really sort of two other issues to think about. One is the question of what impact is the trial going to have on President Trump in the conduct of American foreign policy? And I think that's a very hard question to answer. We're not really sure. But what I do know is that every move the president makes in foreign policy is going to be subjected to an intense amount of media scrutiny and speculation about his motives.
Well, we've already seen the attack that killed Qasem Soleimani. Some people were using the phrase wag the dog in terms of generating news in such a way to divert attention and support the president's case and so forth.
Yeah, we're going to see a lot more of that because, again, I think once it goes to trial with the attention being focused on it, everything goes up to 11 on the 1 to 10 scale.
I know you're going to point out one other thing, Jim. One quick question, though. Is there a chance this trial goes up to and beyond the scheduled State of the Union address on February 4th? Because that would be quite interesting drama as well.
I think right now, nobody knows how long this trial is going to last. Sort of the betting money going in is 2 weeks. However, I just think that there's a lot of moving parts here, and we could end up in a situation where it runs longer than that. I think in that case, there may be a move to postpone or delay the delivery of the State of the Union address. We'll sort of see how that plays out. And again, we don't know what other information may come up in the next several weeks. Again, flip side is this trial could be over in less than 2 weeks. I mean, the range of possibilities here is quite large. The other thing I just wanted to point out about thinking of how the trial is going to play out and its consequences is the effect it's going to have on the Democratic presidential race. You mentioned February 4th, scheduled time of the State of the Union. Well, the day before is February 3rd. That's the Iowa caucuses.
That is correct.
And you know, you basically have of the six leading Democratic candidates, three of them are United States senators. You're thinking Senator Klobuchar, Senator Sanders, and Senator Warren. They're all going to have to be in Washington, D.C., while while Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, and Tom Steyer are crisscrossing Iowa or dropping in on New Hampshire or visiting South Carolina. And so, you know, there's going to be a lot of question of how does that affect the dynamics? You know, are we going to see sort of disputes break out in the Democratic Party? People believe the trial is being used or delayed to hurt the candidacies of more progressive candidates. You can see a variety of ways in which this could become very controversial. And I will note that Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee, she's a Republican. Yesterday, she called on Klobuchar, Sanders, and Warren to recuse themselves from the trial, citing, let me quote her here, unparalleled political interest, end quote, in removing Trump from office. Now, I don't expect Senators Klobuchar, Sanders, and Warren to remove themselves from the trial, but I can also imagine on Twitter, cable news, where people feed on controversy, this could become a bigger and bigger issue.
Wow, high drama indeed. Okay, well, hold on, and here we go.
Bob, let's move away from the impeachment process and talk about China. This year, the Chinese Lunar New Year falls on Saturday. That's the 25th. And this will mark the transition from the year of the pig to the year of the rat. Now, amid the preparations for the multi-week celebration, there is a concerning and mysterious pneumonia-like outbreak in the city of Wuhan in the Hubei province of China. Now, this virus has captured attention because it's similar in many ways to the virus known as severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS. People may remember about a decade ago. So, Bob, can you give us a sense of how the outbreak might affect China and its surrounding neighbors as literally millions of people travel throughout the region during what is a big time for celebration?
Absolutely, Jim. It is very much a time of movement and usually a very festive atmosphere, both in people traveling to see relatives, to go to other places in the country, but also the types of foods they eat. And so there are several issues that are raising concern here. One, as you say, this illness bears a very sort of uncomfortable similarity to SARS. However, a big difference being the human-to-human transmission has not been borne out in any fashion that we've seen yet. It has been cases that have been reported outside of China now, at latest report, both Vietnam and in Japan. People who were afflicted seem to have recovered fully and not spread it to anyone else, nor do they seem to have gotten it from another person. That is being watched extremely closely. But it's happening also at a time, and our colleague Yan Zhang Huang has written about this for our website. It's happening at a time when there's also been a really devastating outbreak of swine fever in the country. It's
Are the two related, or there's entirely separate issues?
At the moment, it looked to be separate issues. And again, this is something, though, that involves pork and involves the spread of illness via the consumption of pork or the proximity to pigs. Pork stocks have plummeted because of the culling of herds to try to, you know, cut down on the incidence of this. And we should note, China has now had, because of SARS in particular, it has really ramped up its ability to respond to this. There were still a number of concerns that it was slow in reporting this latest illness. By a couple of weeks, they were pressed by global authorities to sort of shed some light on what was happening. Now they have, doesn't have the most open discourse within the country on the media, but they are reporting diligently by appearances where the cases are seen. They're keeping an eye on what's happening in Hong Kong, where some cases have been reported or suspected cases. When people arrive in Hong Kong, there is this whole screening process that goes on where people are checked for this illness. And it's sent a concern to throughout Asia. Actually, I mentioned Vietnam. It was Thailand and then Japan where other cases were seen. But there are concerns that suspected cases also in Singapore, just given the nature of travel, given the nature of ethnic Chinese movements marking this Lunar New Year, which is marked basically until up to mid-February. There's just a great deal of caution about not assuming that there is no capability of human transmission of this. And so they have to take these precautions, Jim, but there has been just far too many of these types of outbreaks in recent years causing a huge amount of unease. And so it's a test for a country that still has places like Wuhan where there's these, you know, major open marketplaces where disease could spread. The animal to human possibility, the human to human, and then just the general closeness of people traveling together raises the specter of some sort of infection spreading. So it's being watched very closely. Again, the good news is that it's not approached levels that SARS did. SARS ended up killing more than 700 people and really caused, people recall in the early 2000s, it caused a kind of a clampdown and a lockdown down on travel for a while they were trying to get a grip on it. And again, it did trigger better reporting mechanisms for China. The WHO, the World Health Organization, got heavily involved in pressing Chinese authorities to monitor and report on this. So we're hoping that this year of the rat kicks off in a way that's not marred by any sort of mass illness.
Yes, I think it's going to be very interesting to follow this, both in terms of what happens with this virus and how long it takes scientists to gain the necessary understanding of transmission, lethality, ways to respond to it, and the like. But I think it's also going to be very interesting to watch how the Chinese government handles it. You mentioned Yan Zhonghuang, our colleague, who's sort of written about a lot of this, and he has noted that, at least this time around, the Chinese government seems to be a bit more transparent. But sort of the whole nature of being transparent, letting information flow, letting people know that perhaps the government has done something wrong, isn't the way of the Chinese Communist Party. So in some sense, this is the exact kind of problem that points to real weakness, indeed, I think a brittleness in the Chinese political system. And one could imagine a variety of ways this could play out that would increase the stresses on the Chinese leadership.
No, it's a really good point, Jim. And again, it's when you have a public health crisis that can jump borders like this, you just can't be in the business of controlling information. And so we saw, just thinking of another example, when the Ebola outbreak occurred in these destitute African countries, and for all the problems there in terms of the way information was conveyed, at least you did have pretty up-to-the-minute reporting on where Ebola was being cited, and also the quashing of reports of Ebola spreading to places like Nigeria, where it was pretty much any sort of susceptibility there. Nigerian authorities reacted pretty quickly. Again, we're waiting to hear, we're relying on the fact that Chinese authorities not only having the capability to counter the illness through their own healthcare skills, but also the information flow being such that, you know, people can be at ease and also can make plans, whether it's people traveling on holiday or businesses or what have you. It has a whole knock-on effect.
It certainly does. And I think this is going to be something to watch. And obviously, for people who are in the public health space, traditional concern for a long time has always been the appearance of a new virus, a new disease of particular lethality that spreads easily and that would go from being a localized incident to a global pandemic. That doesn't seem to be the case here, but I think watching how governments respond, particularly the Chinese government respond to this issue, can give you some sense of whether or how confident to be in how governments respond to the potential for a pandemic-like instance.
Jim, another migration of sorts that occurs this time of year is to Davos, Switzerland, and that would be the World Economic Forum annual meeting. This year, about 50 or so heads of state from around the world are set to travel there. The focus this year is supposed to be on sustainability in the environment. President Trump plans to make the trip to attend the conference. So a lot to talk about, obviously. Can you tell us a little bit about what to expect and why this conference matters?
Davos is probably the international conference for globalization. And during the 1990s, going into the 2000s, it was the place to see and be seen. And it was really sort of the physical manifestation of the notion that we were going toward a more integrated, connected world with people and ideas and goods going across borders. Of course, for the last decade, the trend has been in exactly the opposite direction. We're seeing sort of the renationalization of politics. We are seeing a backlash against globalization. And that's why, in some sense, there are ironies here in Davos. And you note that President Trump is going to the meeting, or at least I should say, as of now, he is scheduled to go to Davos. Whether he sticks to that plan, given the impeachment trial beginning next week, is an open question. But as you mentioned in the intro, the theme of Davos this year is sustainability and the environment. And there's going to be a lot of work about how to improve or track progress on Paris Agreement and sustainable development goals. But obviously, President Trump is somebody who, I think, embodies the renationalization of politics trend, but also is somebody who's been quite hostile to the idea that climate change is a real issue or the one that requires action by individual governments. Just last November, he formally notified the international community that the United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement at the soonest possible time, in about 2 years. So there's a little bit of a disconnect between where global trends are right now and certainly what the President of the United States is championing.
And we just come through a decade that's now been marked as the hottest on record. So plenty to mine out of that for a conference that's supposed to be dealing with the environment. But you're right. I mean, I think about what, as you described this as a sort of the focal point of globalization and discussions. And it used to be people who tended used to be known as quote unquote Davos man, even if they were a woman. It was Davos man was this sort of symbol of of the global figure astride the stage. And when necessary, Davos Mann would also exhibit aspects of corporate social responsibility. It's not really clear what's going to emerge from this year's Davos, Jim, even if President Trump does not attend.
Certainly. And I think, you know, one of the big questions that's going to obviously happen here is what kind of conversations are going to be happening on the side? I mean, these bilats can be as important, if not more important, than whatever's formally on the agenda. Now, I haven't seen any schedule come out of the White House in terms of what President Trump's bilateral meeting schedule might look like. I do know that at Davos, there are going to be an awful lot of trade and finance ministers gathering around. And obviously, for President Trump, trade policy is a big issue. He has been very critical of the international trade system. We just had the deal wrapped up with China, the so-called China Phase One trade deal, which is either a major breakthrough, according to the White House, or not much of a breakthrough, indeed, even a retreat if you talk to the president's critics. But obviously, potential for a lot happening on the trade front as this goes down. I will note that Greta Thunberg, the Swedish teenager who I think caused somewhat of a sensation last year, I believe was named Times Person of the Year, will be in Davos. She and other climate activists are going to be pushing very hard for all the Davos attendees to halt all investments in fossil fuel exploration and extraction and immediately end all subsidies to fossil fuel companies. I don't expect that effort to go very far. And indeed, President Trump represents the other end of that political debate because he has championed and highlighted what is a trend that long predates his administration, which is fossil fuel development here in the United States, the development of fracking, and the United States really emerging as, well, I think actually now we are the world's largest producer of oil and gas. So that's another conversation that's going to be had at Davos.
And just to confirm, you will not be going this year, Jim.
Bob, my rule is to go away from snow, not towards snow.
Got it.
I also wasn't invited. Bob, let's move on to our figures of the week. This week's audience figure, which comes to us via our Twitter poll, is Vladimir Putin. Bob, why is the audience pointing to the president of Russia?
Well, to the surprise of exactly no one, the president of Russia has signaled that there are going to be some changes involved that position him to continue to serve Russia beyond the constitutional limit of two terms as president. So his term as president runs out in 2024. He took steps this week that seem to look like they will be enhancing the role of prime minister in Russia, and in such a way that when 2024 rolls around, he himself could assume that role. For the time being, he has nominated the head of the Russian Tax Service, Mikhail Mishustin, if I got that pronunciation correct, to step in and replace Dmitry Medvedev. In fact, he's replacing the whole cabinet. And there's a whole sorts of speculation. Obviously, it's all about the president for life aspect, but as well as why now, what are the signals domestically? It's not really a surprise in some ways that he might want to shuffle around things domestically. Russia has been striding the world stage in a more muscular way recently, whether you look to the Middle East or elsewhere. But domestically, its record is quite different. And I think the president is looking to maybe rev things up on the local front. Dmitry Medvedev, the now ousted prime minister, had a very low approval rating. I think he was sort of, although he's been very loyal supporter of the president, is now seen as sort of sacrificed as part of this move, which is, again, is years ahead of time, is setting the stage for Vladimir Putin to pivot into the next sort of position of power. We should note he did this several years ago. I think there was a 2008-2012 period where he was a prime minister who essentially led the country while Mr. Medvedev was president, and then he became president again. It does not augur well for democratic trends in Russia. And it's a question, though, about, again, to what extent this shuffle at the moment is going to lead in any policy change directions, if not domestically, then internationally.
Bob, have we seen any early reactions among ordinary Russians about this decision? I ask because last year, Russia saw a fair number of local protests about the failures of the government. Are people turning out in the streets saying we want to keep the old system of government, not change it, not have a leader for life? Or is the sense, at least now, for most Russians to just shrug in their shoulders, this is the way the world works?
At the moment, it appears to be a bit of more of the shrug, Jim, than it filling up the streets in protests. It doesn't mean that people are not concerned about it and that the people who were part of those protests have not voiced concern. We've seen the charge of constitutional coup raised, and also concerns about further clampdowns on public expression. Among the areas there's concern about is internet. Russians are still able to convey information, express themselves on the internet more freely than, say, in China. And, yep. and I think Putin would like to emulate the China model, the Xi Jinping model. We should know Xi Jinping is a year younger than Putin and himself has orchestrated a leadership for life model there. And he and President Xi and President Putin have been making a more common cause recently, we should say. So, yeah, I think it remains to be seen what steps might trigger, you know, sort of street protests, Jim. But it's certainly a bit of angst, but I'm not sure whether it's going to add up to much at this point.
So there doesn't look to be a viable anti-Putin force operating in Russia right now.
No, I would say no. Jim, who or what is your figure of the week?
Bob, my figure of the week is a number, and I'm going with the number 3, as in the EU 3. That's a term of art for Germany, Britain, and France, and their role in the Iran nuclear deal. And the EU 3 made news this week because they formally accused Iran of violating the terms of the 2015 nuclear deal. They did so ostensibly in response to Iran's announcement back on January 6th that it was no longer going to abide by the deal and, in fact, had scrapped limits on enriching the uranium. Now, I want to be very careful here that this move sets up the potential, underscore potential, for the enactment of what are called snapback sanctions. That is, to reinstitute the sanctions that the United Nations had placed on Iran before the deal and that were lifted because of the deal. It doesn't make that imposition or implementation of snapback sanctions inevitable. All this is going to be subject to negotiation. And I also want to be clear that in doing this, the EU3 isn't joining the U.S. maximum pressure campaign against Iran. I think what London, Paris, and Berlin are trying to do is to get the Iranians to take a positive step that might be able to stimulate potential talks or negotiations on this to get a new and better deal. We will see how all of that plays out. I will note that the initial reaction from Iran was to denounce the European move, and so the initial situation doesn't seem conducive to a settlement. But obviously, when you're negotiating, there's no incentive to make the other side think you're about to give in or concede something, even if you may be willing to do so.
Do the European states or the EU3 at least have that much leverage at this point in terms of what kind of business they were doing or conducting with Iran? It seemed like there was a great deal of, if not official, then unofficial obeying of the U.S. sanctions that had been ramping up dramatically over the last several months so that European firms wouldn't do business even if their leadership was saying it was okay.
Reality is, no, they don't. The fact is, the United States is a dominant player in the international economy, certainly in the international financial system. The Trump administration is quite happy to impose so-called secondary sanctions. That is, companies that aren't U.S. companies, if they engage in trade with Iran, then the United States would just shut them out of the U.S. market. And as you point out, most European firms looked around and said, the Iran market's small potatoes compared to being in the U.S. market. So it doesn't matter that Berlin or Paris or London want us to work with Iran. It's not in our own corporate interest to do so. I don't think any of that is going to change. But I also think that if you look at the European Union, it has sort of two big concerns. One is that it worries about what will happen if the Iran deal, in fact, does come apart. They don't want a nuclear Iran, and they are skeptical that the maximum pressure strategy can produce regime change that will somehow save us from having to confront the fact of Iran moving toward a nuclear capability. I also think the Europeans worry, given their proximity to Iran, about Iranian operations, clandestine operations on their soil. We've seen a movement in the last several months of European countries publicly pointing to malign activities by the Iranians in Europe. So I think they also see it as a security threat. You know, I guess the consensus in Europe would be great if we could come back and get a better deal where the Iranians give up some more, the United States and Europe gets more from the Iranians. And I think Prime Minister Boris Johnson of Great Britain said he wants to get the Trump deal. And so maybe we will get a Trump deal, but that's by no means certain.
And we should note that Iran has always maintained officially it is not pursuing a nuclear weapons program. is not interested in such. While it does resent the sanctions against its civilian nuclear program, it does not intend to. And at the moment, it remains within the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, so that UN inspectors are allowed to inspect various sites.
Is that correct? I think that's important to state that the Iranians continue to allow IAEA inspections, and the Iranians have not, to this point, conducted anything, to the best of our knowledge, that would qualify as a breakout or surge in nuclear activity. But what about you, Bob? What is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure of the week is a person, and it is Mustafa Qasem. This is an American citizen who died in an Egyptian prison this past week after he had been engaged in a series of hunger strikes protesting his imprisonment. He had been arrested and detained since 2013, sort of caught up in a crackdown by Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi after his military takeover. He was visiting at the time and just, as I said, got caught up in something that truly seemed to be beyond him. And yet, despite various appeals, including right up to President Trump, he was never able to get his freedom. The president, we should note, was able to secure the freedom of some other Egyptian Americans in recent years. But the case of Mr. Qasem was not resolved. It is unclear the extent to which official U.S. channels are pressing the Egyptians on what happened here and whether or not there's going to be any follow-up to this. But one would think that that would happen given the sort of outspoken nature of the president's comments on other Americans held elsewhere and his touting of his track record on freeing them. His current national security advisor, actually, Robert O'Brien, had played a role previously in freeing Americans held unjustly in other countries, including Iran. But I think this is a real test for the administration in some ways. It could be interesting to see whether or not this death and the treatment of Mr. Qasem, because he was reportedly tortured repeatedly, whether this sort of evokes Magnitsky-style measures by the U.S. Congress. And this is in reference to Sergei Magnitsky, the Russian lawyer who was killed in captivity and has really triggered a series of serious targeted sanctions against individuals in Russia and elsewhere.
Why haven't we heard more about this case, Bob, particularly given two things? One, President Trump has been quite happy to apply maximum pressure on lots of other governments. We certainly have leverage over the Egyptians. But the other thing is, you just mentioned, it's an American citizen who we have good reason to believe was being tortured.
Absolutely, Jim. I don't know. I've been looking for more details on the case. It does seem like this is a sort of a thoroughly average guy who was tragically caught up in this case. He was a taxi driver back on Long Island, and perhaps didn't have the sounding board he needed to get his case sort of escalated. Whatever appeals were made, and there were certainly a number of reports from human rights bodies and himself and his own backers, it just did not seem to resonate. I will be curious to see how far this particular case continues and persists, and whether or not, again, there is some movement towards getting accountability from the Egyptians. But we should note there's a strong security relationship between the United States and Egypt. Egypt is a very large recipient of U.S. military aid, and so that is a factor as well. So it remains to be seen, Jim. It's at the moment, it remains a tragic case and a case that should cause some alarm for Americans who travel in countries with authoritarian leadership.
Certainly should.
Well, that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The UK Africa Investment Summit is held in London, and Russia marks the anniversary of Lenin's death.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Our recording engineers were Anthony LeBerry and Nick Sander. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long.